Good morning, everyone. We have a full agenda this morning. We are going to try to go in some sort of order, but we may skip around a little bit if there's certain representatives and or senators walk into the room with interest of a specific bill. But we are going to start with 2661 to open a work session. 2661. Mr. Putman, we heard this bill on, I think it was Monday, is that correct? And at that time, we got amendments. We had a fiscal showed up, kind of its 11th hour. Will you speak to the fiscal issue, Mr. Putman?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. As I understand it, the budget for this agency does not go through the normal budget process because they're a semi-independent agency.
Okay. My discussions with the Speaker's office indicated, in fact, that is correct. This issue is not decided in our Ways and Means Committee, so if the committee so chooses, we could move the bill to the floor without going to Ways and Means. We have a dash one amendment that we spoke to at our last meeting that we would need to adopt prior to moving the bill.
Mr. Chair, I'll move the dash one amendment.
Representative Gardner moves the dash one amendment to House Bill 2661. Discussion on the motion? Objections? Hearing none, so ordered. Representative Gardner.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to move House Bill 2661 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Gardner moves House Bill 2661 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion on the motion. None. We'll call the roll, and Representative Thompson is excused today.
Chair Beyer.
Aye.
Representative Marcet.
Aye.
Representative Lundquist.
Lundquist? Excused. Yes.
Representative Cano? Oh,
Representative Lundquist is here now if he wishes to vote. 2661.
Representative Lundquist?
Aye.
Representative Cano?
Aye.
Representative Gardner?
Aye.
Representative Atkinson?
Aye.
We have everyone?
We did.
Okay. House Bill 2661, having received the required number of votes, moves the floor with a due pass recommendation. Would you like to volunteer to carry that bill? Representative Atkinson volunteers. So, session closed. So now, open a work session on House Bill 2520. We heard this bill earlier. It was Deanna Montgomery who spoke to the issue. We have a dash one amendment in the bill. Mr. Putman, would you like to bring us up to date a little bit with that dash one amendment?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. The original bill has no limit on the quantity of drugs that you could buy under your insurance plan. This dash one amendment makes two changes. It limits that quantity to a 90-day supply. The insurance company could go more than that if they wished, but they wouldn't have to. Secondly, if they do go for more than a 30-day supply, then the insurer is allowed to require prior authorization.
Okay, I don't know if we have a sign-up sheet on this amendment. Mr. Tom Holt is here. He would like to speak to it. I don't know if, Bruce, would you like to speak to the amendment? I don't see anybody else in the room that likes to speak to it. Brian?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Tom Holt. I'm Executive Director of the Oregon State Pharmacists Association. Our membership includes approximately 230 independent pharmacies in Oregon. What the effect of the we heard testimony in the previous hearing that it's fairly routine to have a 90-day supply allowed for mail order filling of prescription drugs. So the effect of this amendment is to put the storefront retail pharmacy in a parity situation with the mail order The insurer would have something that they don't have with the others of the prior authorization ability. And so, in effect, what we have here is something that allows a person who wants to see a real live pharmacist in person to talk about their maintenance medications from time to time to be able to do that instead of being forced into a mail order.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, we have a fiscal impact on the original bill of no fiscal impact. I'm of the opinion that the Dash 1 amendment would not change that.
Okay, Representative Morissette.
Would that also be price parity? Would it give a better price break to the consumer at the drugstore as it does with the mail order?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Morissette, I couldn't guarantee that, but I would anticipate that since the pharmacy would incur two fewer refill incidents, then there would be a less cost to the pharmacy, and I would expect that insurers would adjust their contracts accordingly.
And one copay.
There would be one copay.
Yeah.
I should say this bill doesn't say it is silent as to what would happen with the copays. An insurer would certainly be free to say that you have to do a 3 months' worth of copay.
Law.
Any questions? Discussions? Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Committee members, on this bill, I don't think this is a mandate, so to speak, because from what the insurance lobby had testified at the first meeting, that this they have this currently in their policies. Most insurances do, but with the pre-authorization, except for the part versus mail order versus go to any pharmacist. I don't know if anybody in the insurance group would like to speak to that issue on it, but they don't seem to be running forward, but I assume they don't want to talk about it.
Mr. Chairman, do you know, does insurance industry work with these amendments, or do you know?
My understanding from the negotiations, and I recognize that Deanna McHenry's not here, and she's right. The one that was doing the negotiations, and maybe Tom could speak to it. My understanding is the insurance lobby was not overly happy with the amendments. I think that would be a fair.
I believe that would be fair.
Not want to nod ahead one way or another?
Is declining to nod his head is what I think.
I recognize that that was.
The overwhelming support is not apparent at the moment.
I would say that's a safe statement that their support is not apparent. As I said, my personal feeling is that this bill, even with the amendments, probably doesn't change current practices. I think this is still allowed. I'm going to leave this up to the will of the committee. I personally, you know, I don't know that this is needed or if it will actually do anything. We're in work session. We have the bill and amendments before us. I will leave it up to the, you know, local committee where we want to go with it from that point forward. President Morissette.
Could I ask Tom a question?
Yeah. Please back up, Tom.
Under the current practice, the pharmacy does not have to or may not be able to give a prescription over 30 days. Is that correct?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Morissette, yes, that's correct. In general, the usual limitation is approximately 30 days at a storefront pharmacy.
Could the patient ask the doctor to call the pharmacist and extend it to 90 days? Is that possible in the current statute?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Morissette, the most common policy in that case would be, I believe the doctor would have to, or the patient would have to work through the insurer to get special permission to do that outside of a mail order situation.
Okay. Mr. Chair, I do feel then that this bill does make a difference, and it could meet certain needs in a rural area. In fact, as I remember, Mrs. Montgomery said that she's 20 miles from a pharmacy, and to have to go through that routine to get the 90-day prescription could be difficult, and I think this bill would settle that situation. So I do see it making a difference, and I guess I would support moving ahead with it.
Okay, well, my understanding from what was testified at the first committee meeting was that insurance companies currently do allow up to 90 days worth of prescriptions if the insurer calls ahead and gets pre-authorization. And, you know, they may have to jump through a few hoops. I don't know if this bill changes that, but I think the only thing it does is that I think under the current 90-day prescription filling limitations, they may have to do it through mail order, where this says they can go to a local pharmacy. I think maybe that is a subtle change. If in fact it is a change, I don't think that an insurance company would, if you called and pre-authorized under current law and current policy conditions, that an insurance company would probably authorize you to go to a pharmacy, and maybe they require a triple copay or something like that. I don't know, and this doesn't say they couldn't do that.
Mr. Chairman, if I might speak to the question, the current situation, as I understand it, would be that in individual situations, a person might be able to get an extension. In fact, you know, there was testimony about getting special filling for being on an extended trip, for example. What the amendments say is that the would have a 90-day ability in all situations, but the insurer would have the option of imposing a prior authorization requirement. So the prior authorization would not necessarily exist unless the insurer chose to put it in.
Gordon, looks like you're ready to say something.
Oh, just, you know, I think that in that case it does do a little something.
Well, does this side want to weigh in on this issue?
Yes, you are. Don't we have something?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I'll take a whack at this one. I guess I am going to support this bill, and probably for only one reason, is my deep respect for the First Lady of Cascade Locks. And I really don't see that there's this bill actually does that much, so I'm not sure that it's completely necessary. And I don't know that it's I think the bill could be improved to actually do something. And I think if we spend a little bit of time on it, we probably could, but I know that we're short for time, so I'm willing to give this bill a chance on the floor.
Mr. Chair, the insurance company, according to the amendments, actually, they're not locked in, because if they require a 30-day, it only gives them, allows them to do that if they want. Is that correct?
Well, Mr. Chair, or Representative Lundquist, I think what it says is that they are locked into 90 days, but they may require pre-authorization to go more than 30. So under current law, they're locked into 30 days,
right.
but they do grant you 90 with pre-authorization. This says that they may require pre-authorization to go to 90, but they can't stop that. So that it's a very subtle difference, I guess I would say.
I guess I'm trying to think financially how it's really going to affect insurance companies.
I think the argument that the insurance companies, and I hate to speak for them, but I think the argument they have made in the work group is that if they are putting out 30 or 90 days worth of pills on a policy that's only paid for 30 days, then they have to do one of two things. They either have to raise the price of their policies so they are covered for 90 days out, or they run the risk of a person getting 90 days worth of pills and canceling the insurance policy, so they have just paid for an extra 60 days of pills that they're not going to get premium for. That is the argument against the issue. Where currently they have the option of not allowing it except for under pre-authorization conditions.
Thank you. I can't imagine a person canceling an insurance policy on such a small matter, but I mean, I guess that's the worst case scenario that they can think of, and it will probably, well, I, I would stop there. I just don't think that's a significant argument. And I do think it does make it possible for a patient to do something they can't do now. And it's a small thing, but we're spending too much time on it. So let's move this.
Well, Mr. Chair, if we're through a discussion, I'll just move the dash one amendment.
We've been waiting for us.
Yeah.
President Gardner moves the dash one amendments to House Bill 2520. Discussion on that motion now. Objections? Seeing none, so ordered.
Mr. Chair, I'll move House Bill 2520 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Gardner moves House Bill 2520 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion on the motion. Clerk will call the roll.
Representative Atkinson?
Aye.
Representative Gardner?
Aye.
Representative Knoop?
Aye.
Representative Lundquist?
Aye.
Representative Morissette?
Aye.
Chair Byer?
Aye.
Having received the required number of votes, House Bill 2520 moves to the floor of the House with due pass recommendation. Representative Montgomery can carry his bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Good.
We will now go to, I'm going to skip down the agenda a little ways because I saw Representative Mannix come into the...
He had to go down to council.
Oh.
Because he's missing an amendment.
Okay. And we'll go to House Bill 3434. We'll open the work session on House Bill 3434. We heard this bill. We gave a list of concerns to the sponsors of the bill. They went to the Legislative Council. They had an amendment drafted. We have that amendment in our package. I see we now have a dash four that I had not seen earlier. So, Brand, we have a sign-up sheet. Does anyone want to speak to the bill?
I don't have
thank you.
Oh, you don't? Okay. Okay. I'll let Mr. Putman talk about the dash fours.
Mr. Chairman, the dash fours are identical to the dash three that were in your packet, except for the sentence that says delete lines 4 through 14 of the original bill. Dash 3 was intended to be a gut and stuff. As it appeared to the committee, it was only a stuff. They forgot to take out the other language, and the dash 4 does it.
Okay, that's a fairly significant change, I might add. Members, they...
just one other word.
Okay, Mr. Putman.
The dash 4 also encompasses the language we'd seen earlier in the dash 1.
Did we see a dash 1?
I don't know if you did or not. Yes,
you did a dash 1. Okay.
The dash 1 is now section 4 of the dash 4.
Okay. Members, when... In my notes, the concerns that I had that I wanted addressed, I believe there were two that the dash three did not address of my concerns. One of those being when a multiple broadcast or notices are required, one would have to be in a print media. The other then could be the choice of the local government entity. That is that was not in the dash threes, and I'm assuming it's not in the dash fours also. That was a concern of mine. That did not get into the amendments. Another thing that I had asked for was to maybe pilot this into some sort of an area to see where it works or does not work. That is not in the amendment. So that's my reading of the amendments. Is there anyone that sponsored the amendments? I know that... the name is Pat Egan is over in the finals today. This is 2238. Pat is having a final this morning. I thought, Gary, did you want to speak to it?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm Gary Conkling, here today on behalf of the Oregon Association of Broadcasters, and apologize that Mr. Egan is studying to be a lawyer today. And take,
we're sorry about you.
And we provided legal notice in the Statesman Journal today of that. Mr. Chair, we have attempted to try to work on amendments on this bill to satisfy people, and I think you indicated that we haven't succeeded in making everybody happy with this bill, and our hope would be that you would consider it favorably, but if you do not, we're prepared to continue to work on it in the interim and try to come back next session on it. I don't know what else you would like me to say today other than the obvious that we haven't satisfied all the parties.
Thank you, Mr. Conkling. My last conversation with Pat was we discussed then about the issue of maybe doing an interim study on the issue. Did he discuss that with you at all, or did he authorize you to speak to that?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, that's what I'm sort of indicating, that during the last interim, we had some conversations with local government officials. They've expressed the interest to us in having more flexibility in terms of using different kinds of media that match with their audiences. And without going backwards, today all of the media, electronic and print, are much more segmented to various audiences, and in fact some work better both because of their timeliness as well as their outreach to certain audiences. Clearly we're stepping into territory here where our brethren in the newspaper industry have been the principal means of communicating legal notices in the past. We're sensitive to that. Our goal is to not really tread over their toes, but rather to try to create new options. So it would seem that working in the interim further would make sense, since we haven't apparently achieved consensus on this, and we're prepared to do that.
Yes, thank you. I appreciate that, Gary. And I guess my main concern is, having served 12 years in local government, is there needs to be, I believe, a written record that people can refer to, that the jurisdiction can say it is in print. Now, if the broadcast media could somehow make sure that this was in writing somewhere, at least in the libraries, but that to me is the compelling argument for the print media, is that there is something there that people can refer to. So I think that's something you have to take into consideration when you look at how to make adjustments.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Morris said, in fact, radio and television stations do have written records that for a variety of regulatory means they do provide. So in fact, that isn't an unattainable goal. They have to manifest and really keep records fairly clearly for
Mr. Chair. Well, I guess I'm getting at to make them readily available to people who may not hear them on the air. And if you're going to pursue this, I think that you need to work with the print media to work out some sort of a compromise where you make sure that there is something available, that people don't have to call the station and say, did you run this ad, because I haven't heard it.
Yeah, and again, Mr. Chair and Representative Morissette, with the advent today of a variety of electronic tools, for example, including email and web pages, much of the contact that people have with either electronic media or the printed media, the interactive contacts are through electronic media themselves. So I think it's one of the interesting ironies that the way many people will be verifying information, whether it arrives at their place of business or their home through a printed copy or through a broadcast medium, may well be through electronic contact, so web pages and email. So I think that is attainable. It obviously is a new area and will require some further discussion.
Thank you. We We are in work session.
Mr. Chair, it sounds like this is one that needs a little bit more work in the interim, and certainly encourage those interested parties to keep working on the idea, possibly bring something back to us another time.
Okay. Members, if someone would care to make a motion on the bill, I will accept the motion, and we can take a vote on it. Otherwise, in the absence of a motion, we will close the work session. We will now go to a public hearing. Public hearing on House Bill 2238. Open a public hearing. Mr. Huttman, we have the bill we've heard at least twice before. We have a dash one and a dash two in our packet, and we've just been handed a dash three and a dash four. So, Mr. Putman, if you could hand those out, and Representative Mannix, would you like to come speak? You the author of the dash threes and fours.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I'm Representative Mannix. I appreciate the opportunity to come in front of you to speak to the dash three and dash four amendments to House Bill 2238. The Dash 3 amendments reflect some earlier efforts in other legislation to try to refine the approach that we take to employee versus independent contractor status in the state of Oregon. In the Dash 3 amendments, you will find a set of amendments that have been developed after reading the letters from the federal government about their interpretation of the employment laws and reading the letters from the state employment department about their interpretation, and as you see in the Dash 3 amendments, we move away from a concept I've been pushing before, which was reliance on a contract as meaning something, the paper itself, the document. We move away from talking about burdens of proof or presumptions and instead focus on the traditional concepts of the independent contractor. In the Dash 3 amendments, we set up an option where if there's an individual who is free from control or direction over the performance of their services, both as agreed upon and in fact, and if this is a professional person who is providing these services within the individual's profession, and the person is free to provide these services to others, and if that person is free to determine when and where to provide those services, and that person carries professional liability insurance, that person is not considered an employee. The example I would give you is the contract attorney who goes to work for the law firm and comes in to work for a certain number of hours, can also work at another law firm as long as there's no conflict of interest for a certain number of hours, is moving around. Often that kind of work might be performed by somebody who is filling in for attorneys on vacation. The interpretation right now would be that even though that person carries his own liability insurance and he's a professional and he's free from direction and control because every attorney has to use his professional judgment as to the client's work, and even though he's free to come in at a certain number of hours, that some would argue that he has to be an employee. Certainly there could be an agreement that the person is an employee, but this also allows the freedom to assert no, in that situation this person may be an independent contractor. The Dash 4 amendment is more precise to another issue, and by the way, I just use the attorney as an example. You could come up with a number of other licensed professionals. Please note that we're very careful in using a very limited definition of professional person, which is at page 2 of the amendments. It's designed to make sure that those wonderful working people out there who work, for instance, with labor unions and who are very professional in their work, they would not want to be called independent contractors. Well, this makes it clear that, no, you're talking about advanced degrees and special licensing, et cetera, et cetera. This is language that has previously been worked out in terms of defining professional person in a very narrow way. In the future, you could always look at whether it should be broader, but this is a very narrow definition. The Dash 4 amendments relate to a particular kind of enterprise where pharmacists who are licensed go to work part-time, temporary, fill-in through agents or brokers in various enterprises, and I think it's a pretty straightforward. It says if that person's working through an agent or broker, the pharmacist is carrying professional liability insurance, the pharmacist is able to choose the location of work and is free to work for any pharmacy-related enterprise of the pharmacist's choice, that person is not considered someone covered by the definition of employment. Please note this has to do with temporary pharmacy services, not your regular employment of a pharmacist by an enterprise. Nancy Cave is here, and she can testify to the committee about the specific business which she has carried on in the past, where they provide a brokerage service for pharmacists to fill in for small-town pharmacies, for big pharmacies and the like. But the Dash 4 Amendment is typical of a number of very specific exceptions that the legislature has adopted in Oregon law, and this would be added to that list of exceptions. I present these to the committee for your consideration, and I would encourage your adoption of both of them, and I thank you for your courtesy, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee.
Thank you, Representative Mannix. Are there any questions of Representative Mannix before he has to run back to his very important committee, which is in recess right now?
Just one quick question on the Dash 3s. You know, clearly there was testimony prior that there's a federal conformity issue, and this would put at risk the unemployment pool, as it were. Have you any information that would say that this now would meet the federal conformity?
Yes, Representative, Mr. Chairman, Representative Gardner. And in fact, I'm looking quickly to see if I brought it with me. I asked Legislative Council to prepare a letter responding to that issue, and it appears now that I left it sitting on the counter in the office of Legislative Council, that letter points out how they've addressed these issues and how they are satisfied that the federal conformity issues are all addressed by this amendment. I will arrange as soon as I get up from here to have someone go pick up that letter and bring it to the committee.
Thank you. Any other questions? Thank you very much, Representative Manning.
Thank you.
Dale Penn, is still here? Dale, right outside? Okay, Nancy, you want to come up and speak to the debt? You want to speak? And Annette, you want to come up too? Come on up, Annette. Go ahead, Nancy, you want to start?
Honorable Chairman Beyer and members of the committee, I appreciate you taking time to listen to me today. My name is Nancy Cave, and I appreciate this opportunity to address the issues with you in support of proposed amendments to House Bill 2238. I hadn't seen three yet, but three and four. I'm a registered pharmacist in Oregon and operate a small business from my home that I opened 12 years ago. My business is a brokerage for independent contractor pharmacists to serve as a contact with professional or potential clients on a temporary basis. I've met some of you in the past with my volunteer work with OSPA, and I'm presently working with my National Pharmacy Association as PAC chairman. I'm before you today again, and we've rewritten this numerous times, trying to meet the problems that the Employment Division has with the bill. I refuse to believe that anyone in this room intends that only blue-collar workers can be independent businessmen, and that is the way the law is being enforced presently by the Employment Division, and that is why I'm here. We've rewritten House Bill 2434 numerous times and had heard no concern from the Employment Division how to rectify this issue that they are not allowing white-collar workers to work as free business people in the state of Oregon. We've only heard how we can't pass what we've written. We have not heard from them how we can solve this problem. And I'm wondering why that is. You now have before you a narrower solution in House Bill 2238-3, and 4 is very narrow. It just applies to me, and I'm actually embarrassed by it. We've heard repeatedly from the state and the feds that Oregon will be out of compliance for federal matching funds if an entity is considered to be an employee at the federal level but not at the state level, or vice versa. This argument would put Oregon out of compliance presently just because of their interpretation that white-collar workers can't be independent contractors. We're all really aware that on the federal level, white-collar workers certainly can be independent contractors. So based on this argument, just through the way they're interpreting the law, Oregon's presently out of compliance with the federal government. But the reason that this is not a problem is because in the long run, if there was a subject employee at the state level that was an independent contractor at the federal level, the 6.2% taxes would be paid in full to the state, and the feds would receive none, so there would be no reason for the state to have matching funds. So in my understanding is that actually the case is that Oregon would lose no funds at all. They just wouldn't have matching funds, which since they received the full amount, that really is not an issue. That's my understanding from my counsel in Washington, D.C., who has been doing this type of law for 12 years. The Employment Division may argue that the legislature cannot exclude one group, such as pharmacists, brokers. But I wanted to point out ahead of time that both state and federal law does presently do that. And on the federal level, real estate brokers have an exemption. At the state level, paper boys have an exemption. To summarize, my preference is that the new wording is to write a law that will allow professional workers in Oregon to work as independent contractors. I believe Dash 3 does do this. Dash 4 would protect me personally. The most important one to me is Dash 3 because that also protects me. And if the Employment Division still has a problem with the way this is written, I invite them to help us write this law so white-collar workers can be independent contractors. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Questions? Thank you. Annette?
Mr. Chair, members, good morning. Annette Talbot, Legislative Coordinator for the Employment Department. Having just seen the Dash 3 amendment and not seen the letter from Legislative Council, I could certainly not say with any degree of surety that these do or do not have conformity problems. However, the first review of them, I believe that they still probably do have some. I guess, respectfully disagree with Ms. Cabe's statement that the current independent contractor test does not address white-collar workers. It did not address her situation particularly, but I do believe that it does work well for all different types of occupations, and we would certainly be glad to look at the criteria under the independent contractor test piece by piece to review that issue. That's what we have said before. We believe that's where you should go if there's a concern with some of that particular criteria about the independent contractor test. That's what we should be looking at instead of excluding particular types of employment or all professionals who happen to work under a contract. The professionals are no different than other employees. If they're an employee and they have an employer-employment relationship, then they should be covered. So if they're an independent contractor and for some reason they're getting caught up in the test and not being able to qualify, we'd be more than happy to review that with Representative Mannix and Ms. Cabe. This Dash 3 amendment does appear to shift the burden off of the department to and so that the department would have to prove a negative. That has been troublesome to the Department of Labor in the past. And under the current definition, it would also appear to cover state, local, and nonprofit employees, which is potentially a conformity issue. In the past, this definition of professional has potentially covered anywhere from 100 to 200,000 people that would potentially be excluded under this. Again, having just looked at it, I can't tell you for sure, but that is the effect of the last ones. The Dash 4 amendments is an impermissible exclusion, as Ms. Cabe said. However, what does happen is that employer, in this case, would have to pay 6.2% federal tax. That tax does not go to the state of Oregon directly. It goes to the federal government. And instead of, since it's an impermissible exclusion, Mr. Chair members, what that means is they have to pay the full 6.2 federal tax. Normally, they get a credit on their federal tax of up to 5.4%, so they really only pay a net tax of 0.8%. When you have an impermissible exclusion, it requires them to pay the full amount, and they don't get that 5.4% offset. It does not affect our grants. It does just affect the individual employer. It is, however, something that the department, with the governor's backing, has had a policy of not allowing additional impermissible exclusions because of the erosion of coverage issue. Every session, someone new comes to ask to get out of the program. And this amendment is no really different than any other temporary agency that has employees. If the pharmacists were out, then all temporary agencies who have employees could make that same case. They are employees. Yes, they do have the ability to choose when they work and maybe where they work. But when they are at work, they are employees. So that's the difficulty we have with this type of exclusion. Mr. Chair, we would be more than happy to get these to the Department of Labor as soon as I leave the building today and see if there are conformity issues, but I see a few right off the bat that I would be concerned about.
Thank you very much. Questions?
Just to understand, you say the employer would have to pay 5 points?
Mr. Chair, Representative Lundquist, right now their experience rating, you know, they pay a different tax anywhere from 1 to 5.4%. They are given a 5.4% offset on their federal tax. So without this, when they're excluded from Oregon coverage, they have to pay the full federal tax, which is 6.2%. For some employers, that actually makes them not have a very good deal, and they'd be better off being included in Oregon. For some, it works as a good deal. It sort of just depends on what they pay their employees. But as a policy, the department and the governor have opposed impermissible exclusions because we believe it erodes coverage. Again, it does not put our grants at issue. It's not a conformity issue in the traditional sense, but we believe that it over time, we continually every year have a different type of, you know, it's the rafters or the country fair people, or, you know, there's a number each year that have come out. So we would oppose that on that erosion of coverage issue, especially because the way this is worded, that any temporary agency that had employees would have the same argument that Ms. Cave has Blades drafted. They are employees still. They just choose when they want to work and where, but they still have an employee relationship once they get to that site. So, does that answer your question?
So in some cases, it might actually cost them more. In some cases, not.
That's what I'm trying to get clarification on that. Is this which employers is that? Would it be the employer all pharmacists or all pharmacists who claim this temporary service?
Mr. Chair, I would like the tax person, Don Hunter, to come up to answer that, because my understanding is that it would be only would be anybody who has pharmacists.
Donna Hunter, tax manager with the Employment Department. On the -4 amendments, that would be any agency who was sending out temporary pharmacists to its clients. So it would be a temporary agency who specialized in pharmacists, just like you have temporary agencies who specialize in other professionals. So this would be the temporary agencies who would be using pharmacists and sending them out to clients. Those would be the entities that would not get their FUTA offset.
And what would trigger that if the federal government came in and decided that they were, in fact, employers?
Basically, there is no exemption under the federal law for these to be excluded under FUTA. So if they're not paying their taxes, they would basically not get their offset. That could be triggered by a FUTA certification process that we do in comparing our state taxes paid to the taxes that are reported to the IRS. I'm not at all sure what triggers things with the IRS, to tell you the truth.
And excuse me, that would be assuming that they're not meeting federal law. Am I correct?
That would be assuming that they're not meeting the, you're right, the common law definition under the FUTA requirements, under which they have like a 20-question criteria that they use.
Which I meet.
So that's the answer to the question would be then that they would only pay the 6% if the federal, the FUTA comes in, whoever that stands
yeah.
for, Department of Labor comes in and says that, no, you, temporary pharmacist agency, are not a contract employer, and these are actually your employees. So now because you have this exemption in the law, you pay us 6%.
That is correct, Mr. Chair. And it may be that in the way she has set up her business, I have no idea that the IRS has signed off on that. Another a temporary agency who is has workers who are being sent out to clients may or may not meet the criteria.
Thank you. Further questions?
Mr. Chair, I'm not sure who addressed this to, but okay, so some temporary employment services or businesses might need it, some might not. Can anyone give me an idea of how many we know would need it percentage-wise and how many wouldn't?
Mr. Chair, Representative Lundquist, generally speaking, temporary agencies who have workers who send their clients out to these other send their workers out to these other clients generally would be employees, and so generally most of them would be basically not meeting the common law definition. I would suspect there would be some cases that you could have some professionals in the 20 law requirements, a direction and control, tools, right to hire and fire. There's 20 different criteria that we don't use here in Oregon, and they're all kind of like impacted by court cases, impacted by the particular auditor that goes out to do the specific audit. They're really not a recipe such as the 1989 legislature passed here so that both the employer and the independent contractor would have an idea about, are you an employee or not? They're not a clear recipe, and we've heard a lot of concerns about that in the past. So generally speaking, the workers who work for a temporary agency who may choose the site that they go to or the times that they work, they're generally employees. I don't have a specific number, a percentage of all workers who work for temporary agencies, which of those would be employees and which would be independent contractors.
That answers your question. Specifically, temporary pharmacy employers, not all temporary agencies.
I understand that.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
The bail pen, did he ever come back into the room? He must have ran up to, when he saw Representative Mannix come back to committee, he probably had to run back up there also. He had signed up to speak in favor of the Dash 2 amendment. Is there anyone else like to speak to any of the amendments or to the original bill? Seeing no one, will close the hearing on House Bill 2238. I would like to think about a five-minute recess. We have received a letter from the Legislative Council. I'd like to give the committee members a chance to look at that letter, to review it, and we're just going to take that advice, and we will come back at 9:30.